The Diane Rehm Show is carried on 197 stations across the country and reaches an audience of 2.5 million every week. After 40 years in radio, Ms. Rehm plans to retire at the conclusion of the 2016 presidential race. She's written a new memoir called On My Own, in which she recounts having to say goodbye to not only to radio, but to John, her husband of 54 years, after his lengthy and painful battle with Parkinson's disease, and how his struggle inspired her to become an activist for the Right to Die with Dignity movement. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Diane Rehm back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Now, most radio people never want to retire. Why have you decided that it's time for you?
You know, I'm not really going to retire. I'm stepping away from the microphone.
From the Daily Show.
Absolutely. I may, who knows, maybe do a podcast, but I'm going to help continue to support WAMU, public radio. I'm going to advocate publicly for the right to die after I step away from the microphone. I'm going to talk about the need for families to talk with each other about death. It's part of life, Leonard.
But you didn't want to step away before you learned how the 2016 election turns out.
Precisely.
Is it in your blood because you grew up in Washington?
I grew up in Washington, but I really didn't become politically tuned in until I started doing the show. And that truly turned me on, and I tuned in.
You've been covering politics for 4 decades. Doesn't this election feel rather unusual?
Unusual is not a word I would use.
Well, I was trying to be discreet.
I would say something like wacky. I don't get it. I really don't get it and don't understand exactly where the American voting public is right now.
Are you ever upset by the anti-Arab feelings that you hear from some of the politicians?
I think that what some of the politicians have said about Arabs, about Muslims, is not called for in this country.
Well, your background is Arab, but not Muslim. You were Orthodox.
Absolutely.
Christian?
That's right. That's right. My mother and father were both born in Mersin, Turkey, before Syria was even created. My father's family went to Beirut, Lebanon. My mother's family went to Alexandria, Egypt. I was born in this country.
You write that you met John when he was a legal advisor to your boss at the State Department.
Exactly.
How did you come to work as a secretary at the State Department? You hadn't gone to college.
Hadn't gone to college. Started out as the secretary at the D.C. Highway Department. Leonard.
Well, you were a radio dispatcher. Was that
exactly.
Some kind of omen?
You know, who knows? But my boss said to me, every day he'd walk in and say, Diane, get on the radio. Tell those guys they need to fix a pothole at 14th and K or whatever. I mean, and there it was. Then I was recruited to the Postal Inspection Service with a raise, and then the State Department recruited me. So I guess my shorthand and typing were good.
Some of your earliest conversations with John, you say, were about your mutual love for baseball. Weren't you playing second base for the State Department's women's softball team?
I was.
Did he also play?
He played pitcher for the men's softball team, and we got to talking about more than baseball.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. But that was when the Senators were still in Washington.
Senators were still in Washington. You know, Leonard, when I was a little girl growing up in Washington, I actually went to the home of the owner of the Washington Senators, Clark Griffith, for a Halloween begathon. And they invited me into his big study, and I met him. It was lovely.
On the other hand, he was notorious for his ideas about race, and one of the reasons I gather he moved to Minnesota was it was a very white city.
How did I know that?
Yeah.
I was a little kid.
Now, your first dinner date with John, you say, was the result of a bet on who would win the World Series.
Exactly. I don't even remember who was up that year, but we did bet, and I won, and the bet was a dinner. So John pretty quickly invited me to one of the loveliest restaurants in Washington, Chef Francois. And we had a great dinner.
He was your second husband?
He was my second husband. I was married when I was 19 to an Arab man. Lovely guy. But I think he expected me to be the same kind of wife his own mother had been, and I just wasn't cut out for it.
And John, you say, actually wanted to teach and not be a lawyer, and your relationship blossomed because you love learning from him.
I love learning from him. He was the best teacher I ever had.
And he served in both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Was he practicing law the whole time?
He was. He was a trade lawyer and helped to set up the office of the U.S. Special Trade Representative and then became its first attorney under Christian Herter, who had been, of course, governor prior to coming there.
Had he retired from practice when he got his Parkinson's diagnosis?
Yes, he had. You know, I really didn't want him to retire. I felt that 70 was too young for him to retire. But he was tired of the law, tired of the business of law, and so retired at age 71.
But that had to have been slightly odd, a retired husband with a wife who was working every day and
was probably
a lot more famous than he was.
Well, he had planned what he wanted to do. He studied to be a docent at Freer and Sackler for a solid year. He became a reader for the blind and dyslexic and a volunteer at hospice. So for the first few years, it was perfect. He was out and about every day. We bought him a new car. He was so independent and having such a good time. And then he'd wait for me to come home for our nightly walks, and I began to hear a shuffle.
How late after? How much after he retired?
About 5 years.
So around 75.
Yeah, exactly.
My guest is Diane Rehm, who's been the host of the Diane Rehm Show, on WAMU in Washington, D.C. since 1979. She's written a memoir, her fourth book, third by herself. It's called On My Own. It's published by Knopf, and we'll continue our conversation after this. And we're back with Diane Rehm, who's written a memoir called On My Own. It's published by Knopf, your fourth book. Do you enjoy writing?
You know, writing doesn't come all that easily.
But you write for your show.
But, you know, I felt as though this was such an important book. I began writing it, Leonard. I think the night John was dying, I was in his room trying to sleep on two chairs with my little dog on my stomach. Couldn't sleep, got up at 2 a.m, took out my iPad, and just jotted down what I was feeling and what I was seeing, and I think that was really the start of it.
In 1998, you wrote Finding My Voice.
Right.
You didn't do that on the iPad. That was the first time you came on this show.
Exactly. And that was because I had lost my voice. I'm still getting periodic injections of Botox into my vocal cords. But thankfully, listeners have stayed with me all these years despite not having your smooth, dulcet tones.
You have what's called spasmodic dysphonia?
Exactly. And
how common is that?
More common than you'd think. I get lots of emails from people around the country who have it. It begins in the basal ganglia of the brain, which sends an incorrect message to the vocal cords, telling them to clamp down inappropriately. And then I started getting this, and that's the beginning.
Well, you mentioned that John got you to quit smoking. Do you think that played a factor? Or?
Oh, gosh. You know, I smoked.
I've always wondered what would happen if I continued smoking, whether I'd have a better radio voice or a worse radio voice.
Do you smoke now?
No, I quit smoking in the 70s.
Okay. I smoked from the age of 15 to the age of 25. So I did not contract spasmodic dysphonia until 25 years later. I doubt seriously that that had anything to do with it. It is a neurological disorder.
You write that up until 1973, you were happy to be a homemaker, mother of two, but you knew you needed something more because your children were growing up?
They were.
Is that what got you into radio?
Absolutely. I got into radio as a volunteer. How did you get into radio?
Somebody called me and asked me if I wanted to do a show.
They liked your voice.
No, I knew something about black gospel music, so I wound up doing a gospel show.
There you are.
But it was very odd.
And mine was very odd. I mean, that's how we get into radio.
But you volunteered at WAMU, which is a university station, wasn't a member of NPR at the time.
Because you had to have 5 full-time employees to be a member of NPR. And when I began, there were 2, and that was about it.
And everybody else was a college student.
Exactly. That's how it started.
But then you wound up hosting your own show in 1979?
Starting to host the show in 79. It was renamed in 1984 as the Diane Rame Show and went national in 1995 and has been with NPR ever since.
You write that from the beginning of your broadcasting career, John was your greatest cheerleader. You had an extraordinary marriage, but not a perfect one.
Nobody has a perfect marriage, I don't believe, anyhow.
What were some of the challenges of your marriage?
Well, I think...
Don't get into the sex in too much detail.
I promise. The sex was great, but let me tell you about the rest. He needed silence and alone time far more than I did.
And you suggested he went into... He had dark moods at times.
Very dark moods. Needed to be alone. Once said that he'd rather have lunch with the New Yorker magazine than any human being alive, and I knew that included me.
Did writing your joint memoir Toward Commitment, A Dialogue About Marriage, help clear the air at all?
It did. It did. Each of us wrote our own take on, say, religion or money or raising children. Then we went away to our farm for 3 weeks and exchanged those essays. And Leonard, I'll tell you, we had some of the biggest fights during those 3 weeks you can possibly imagine. But we recorded it all. And then I, the perfect secretary, transcribed it all. And that's how we came up with Toward Commitment.
But you did it that way rather than going to a marriage counselor.
We did that too.
You begin the book with John's decision to die. As you told us, he was first diagnosed with Parkinson's quite a while ago. And he had moved into Brighton Gardens, a facility in Chevy Chase, in 2012.
Right.
What was involved in the decision to put him in an institution? Was it just too hard for him to get around?
He began falling. And so we had somebody stay with him during the day while I was at the office to prepare his meals, to help him dress. Finally, one morning at 3 a.m., when I was the only person there, John fell. And I don't know if you've ever tried to lift someone who cannot help him or herself. It's
very
nearly
hard.
Impossible. I finally got him to his knees and dragged him to the bed. And the next day, we talked. And he knew that the time had come. He was going to have to go into a facility. We simply did not have enough room in the condo to which we had moved to have someone there full time.
But he was also upset about the decision.
Well, he didn't show it. He wouldn't show it. He took it stoically, as he did pretty much everything.
How often were you able to visit him there?
Pretty much every day after I left WAMU, I'd go straight there to Brighton Gardens to see him and be with him.
And how old was he at the time?
He died at age 84.
He decided to die, you have the exact date, June 14th.
No, that's the day he began to...
Well, he actually wanted to do something to die.
And he finally died on June 23rd.
9 days later.
9 days later, actually 10 days later, having withdrawn from water, from medications, from food, he said, I am ready to die. And the doctors could not help him die. They could not give him a lethal dose of medication. That would have been against the law, against ethics, against everything that they believe in and are bound by in Maryland. So he took his own life. He relinquished his life by withdrawing from life.
His doctor, Dr. Freed, told him that the only way he could move forward with his decision was to refuse water, food, and medication. Was he in pain during those 10 days between the decision to stop eating and taking medication and
Leonard,
his death?
I was there every single day for those 10 days. I do not believe he was in pain. He was thirsty. His lips were dry. I put sponges into his mouth. I put lotion on his lips and face to try to help that. I do believe that John Rehm should have had the right to say, I'm ready to die. I want to die. Please help me die.
And that's why you've become a Right to Die activist.
Well, I, as you perhaps know, NPR has said to me, and my own station has said to me, I cannot advocate for the right to die and continue to host my daily show.
So they discourage your involvement with an organization called Compassion and Choices.
Exactly. Until I step away from the microphone at the end of the year.
You've been very encouraged by the Supreme Court of Canada in their support of physician-assisted suicide for patients suffering from grievous and irremediable medical conditions.
And
so
California,
could you have moved
then,
to Canada?
I could have, perhaps.
I'm not saying you should have, but is that one of the only options?
You would have had to, as you do in Oregon, you would have had to establish 3-month residence. Have two doctors determine that you are within 6 months of dying. So what I am hoping is that California, having voted to allow this for 10 years and then to reevaluate, that California may become the tipping point for states around the country.
You write that after 54 years of marriage, you were worried about how you would cope on your own.
I was.
You watching more TV these days?
No. I'm out and about. I'm active. I do what I need to do and want to do, and I am far more comfortable being alone than I ever was before.
Although you do say you just turn it on TV for the comfort of voices. People keep radio or TV on.
Radio is what I leave on all day long.
Now, you quote Joan Didion on losing her husband, John Gregory Dunn, so quickly, and you have friends who have lost their spouses suddenly. But this was a long process.
This was a long process. And if you were to ask me, which do you think is harder, to lose someone over a long period or quickly, I don't think anybody can make that decision. It's what's in your own heart.
Well, it hurts to lose somebody either way, but to watch somebody you love suffer is always quite painful.
And
I'm sure you've spoken to quite a few people, including, didn't you speak to Eleanor Clift, somebody we all know about in public radio?
I know her very well. In fact, when John was a volunteer for hospice, Eleanor Clift's husband asked that John come and read to him, which he did.
In 2014, when President Obama presented you with the National Humanities Medal, he said, in probing interviews with everyone from pundits to poets to presidents, Ms. Rehm's keen insights and boundless curiosity have deepened our understanding of our culture and ourselves. You must have been very pleased, because I'm sure that was what, in the back of your mind, you were hoping you were doing.
Well, the announcement to me came 2 days after John's memorial service. All I could think, Leonard, was, I wish he were here. I wish he knew. I hope he knows. I hope he can see.
Over the course of your career, the involvement of your audience has expanded. I know it has for me when I started working on typewriters and in our first offices, we actually had to go to a different floor to get faxes, and or somebody had to deliver them to us. And now we have tweets, Facebook comments on our show page. Do you feel that those things have improved the quality of shows?
Not necessarily. I think that the immediacy of the messages somehow gets through to us that much more quickly. We can still decide which tweets or which Facebook postings we want, and that's what makes us the broadcasters we are, is weeding out those things that make the program move forward and those that don't. I don't think it's necessarily improved it, but it's changed it in some ways.
Well, I find that the best feedback I ever get is just when I meet people, not when I read the comments page. The people who write to comments pages are the people who write to comments pages. Are you going to continue blogging?
I've never blogged.
Are you going to pick up blogging?
I may. You never know. You never know. I don't know. You know what I am going to do? I'm going to continue acting in a play for Us Against Alzheimer's, a play called Surviving Grace. I am a woman who falls into Alzheimer's.
The book On My Own is published by Knopf. And Diane, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.